speaking in the myriad tongues of Babel. They were the very essence of multiplicity, and I see no point in dividing them now. But there were exceptions. In particular, there was Shiva, and there was Parvati the witch. Destiny, historical role, Newman, these were mouthfuls too large for 10-year-old gullets, even perhaps for mine. Despite the ever-present admonitions of the fisherman's pointing finger and the Prime Minister's letter, I was constantly distracted from my sniff-given marvels by the tiny occurrences of everyday life, by feeling hungry or sleepy, by monkeying around with the monkey, or going to the cinema to see Cobra Woman or Vera Cruz, by my growing longing for long trousers, and by the inexplicable below-the-belt heat engendered by the approaching school social at which we, the boys of the cathedral and John Connon Boys High School, would be permitted to dance the box step and the Mexican hat dance with the girls from our sister institution, such as Masha Miovich, the champion breaststroker. "Hee-hee," said Glandy Keith Colico, and Elizabeth Purkis and Janie Jackson, European girls, my God, with loose skirts and kissing ways. In short, my attention was continually seized by the painful, engrossing torture of growing up. Even a symbolic gander must come down at last to earth. So it isn't nearly enough for me now, as it was not then, to confine my story to its miraculous aspects. I must return, as I used to return, to the quotidian. I must permit blood to spill. The first mutilation of Salim Sanai, which was rapidly followed by the second, took place one Wednesday early in 1958, the Wednesday of the much-anticipated social, under the auspices of the Anglo-Scottish Education Society. That is, it happened at school. Salim's assailant, handsome, frenetic, with the barbarian shaggy moustache, I present the leaping, hair-tearing figure of Mr. Emil Zagallo, who taught us geography and gymnastics, and who, that morning, unintentionally precipitated the crisis of my life. Zagallo claimed to be Peruvian, and was fond of calling us jungle Indians, bead lovers. He hung a print of a stern, sweaty soldier in a pointy tin hat and metal pantaloons above his blackboard, and had a way of stabbing a finger at it in times of stress and shouting, "You see him, you savages? These a man ye civilization. You show him respect. He's got a sword." And he'd swish his cane through the stone-walled air. We called him Pargal Zargal, Crazy Zagallo, because for all his talk of llamas and conquistadors in the Pacific Ocean, we knew, with the absolute certainty of rumour, that he'd been born in a Mazagon tenement and his Goanese mother had been abandoned by a decamped shipping agent. So he was not only an Anglo, but probably a bastard as well. Knowing this, we understood why Zagallo affected his Latin accent, and also why he was always in a fury, why he beat his fists against the stone walls of the classroom. But the knowledge didn't stop us being afraid. And this Wednesday morning, we knew we were in for trouble because optional cathedral had been cancelled. The Wednesday morning double period was Zagallo's geography class, but only idiots and boys with bigoted parents attended it, because it was also the time when we could choose to troop off to St. Thomas's Cathedral in crocodile formation, a long line of boys of every conceivable religious denomination escaping from school into the bosom of the Christian's considerably optional God. It drove Zagallo wild, but he was helpless. Today, however, there was a dark glint in his eye, because the croaker, that is to say, Mr. Crusoe, the headmaster, had announced at morning assembly that cathedral was cancelled. In a bare, scraped voice emerging from his face of an anaesthetized frog, he sentenced us to double geography, and Pargal Zargal taking us all by surprise, because we hadn't realized that God was permitted to exercise an option too. Glumly, we trooped into Zagallo's lair. One of the poor idiots whose parents never allowed them to go to cathedral whispered viciously into my ear, "You just wait. He'll really get you guys today." Padma, he really did. Seated gloomily in class, Glandy Keith Colico, Fat Purse Fishwaller, Jimmy Kapadia, the scholarship boy whose father was a taxi driver, Hair Oil Sabamati, Sonny Ibrahim, Cyrus the Great, and I. Others too, but there's no time now, because with eyes narrowing in delight, Crazy Zagalo is calling us to order. "Human geography," Zagalo announces. "This is what?" "Kapadia." "Please, sir." "Don't know, sir." Hands fly into the air. Five belong to church band idiots, the sixth, inevitably, to Cyrus the Great. But Zagalo is out for blood today. The godly are going to suffer. "Feel from the jungle." He buffets Jimmy Kapadia, then begins to twist an ear casually. "Stay in class sometimes and find out." "Ow, ow, ow, yes, sir, sorry, sir." Six hands are waving, but Jimmy's ear is in danger of coming off. Heroism gets the better of me. "Sir, please stop, sir. He has a heart condition, sir." Which is true. But the truth is dangerous because now Zagalo is rounding on me. "So, a little arguer, is it?" And I am being led by my hair to the front of the class, under the relieved eyes of my fellow pupils. Thank God it's him, not us. I writhe in agony beneath imprisoned tufts. "So, answer the question. You know what is human geography?" Pain fills my head, obliterating all notions of telepathic cheatery. "Aye, sir, no, sir, ouch!" And now it is possible to observe a joke descending on Zagalo, a joke pulling his face apart into the simulacrum of a smile. It is possible to watch his hand darting forward, thumb and forefinger extended, to note how thumb and forefinger close around the tip of my nose and pull downwards. Where the nose leads, the head must follow, and finally the nose is hanging down, and my eyes are obliged to stare damply at Zagalo's sandaled feet with their dirty toenails, while Zagalo unleashes his wit. "See, boys? You see what we have here? Regard, please, the hideous face of these primitive creature. It reminds you of..." And the eager response is, "Sir, the devil, sir? Please, sir, one cousin of mine?" "No, sir, a vegetable, sir. I don't know which." Until Zagalo, shouting above the tumult, "Silence, sons of baboons! This object here..." A tug on my nose. "This is human geography." "How, sir? Where, sir? What, sir?" Zagalo is laughing now. "You don't see," he guffaws, "in the face of this ugly ape, you don't see the whole map of India?" "Yes, sir. No, sir. You show us, sir." "See here, the Deccan Peninsula hanging down." Again, ouch my nose. "Sir, sir, if that's the map of India, what are the stains, sir?" It is Glandy Keith Colico feeling bold. Sniggers, titters from my fellows, and Zagalo taking the question in his stride. "These stains," he cries, "are Pakistan. These birthmark on the right ear is the east wing, and these horrible stained left cheek, the west. Remember, stupid boys, Pakistan is a stain on the face of India." "Ho, ho," the class laughs. "Absolute master joke, sir." But now, my nose has had enough. Staging its own unprompted revolt against the grasping thumb and forefinger, it unleashes a weapon of its own. A large blob of shining goo emerges from the left nostril to plop into Mr. Zagalo's palm. Fat Purse Fishwaller yells, "Look at that, sir! The drip from his nose, sir! Is that supposed to be Ceylon?" His palm smeared with goo. Zagalo loses his jokey mood. "Animal!" he curses me. "You see what you do?" Zagalo's hand releases my nose, returns to hair. Nasal refuse is wiped into my neatly parted locks. And now, once again, my hair is seized. Once again, the hand is pulling. But upwards now, and my head has jerked upright. My feet are moving onto tiptoe, and Zagalo, "What are you? Tell me what you are." "Sir, an animal, sir." The hand pulls harder, higher. "Again?" Standing on my toenails now, I yelp, "Aye, sir, an animal, please, sir, hee!" And still harder and still higher. "Once more!" But suddenly it ends. My feet are flat on the ground again, and the class has fallen into a deathly hush. "Sir," Sonny Ibrahim is saying, "you pulled his hair out, sir." And now the cacophony. "Look, sir, blood! He's bleeding, sir! Please, sir, shall I take him to the nurse?" Mr. Zagalo stood like a statue with a clump of my hair in his fist, while I, too shocked to feel any pain, felt the patch on my head where Mr. Zagalo had created a monkish tonsure. A circle where hair would never grow again, and realized that the curse of my birth, which connected me to my country, had managed to find yet one more unexpected expression of itself. 2 days later, Croker Crusoe announced that, unfortunately, Mr. Emil Zagalo was leaving the staff for personal reasons. But I knew what the reasons were. My uprooted hairs had stuck to his hands like bloodstains that wouldn't wash out, and nobody wants a teacher with hair on his palms. The first sign of madness, as Glandy Keith was fond of saying, and the second sign is looking for them. Zagalo's legacy. A monk's tonsure, and, worse than that, a whole set of new taunts, which my classmates flung at me while we waited for school buses to take us home to get dressed for the social. "Snotnose is a baldy," and "Sniffer's got a map face." When Cyrus arrived in the bus queue, I tried to turn the crowd against him by attempting to set up a chant of "Cyrus the Great, born on a plate in 1948. But nobody took up the offer. So we come to the events of the Cathedral School social, at which bullies became instruments of destiny, and fingers were transmuted into fountains, and Masha Miovich, the legendary breaststroker, fell into a dead faint. I arrived at the social with the nurse's bandage still on my head. I was late because it hadn't been easy to persuade my mother to let me come, so by the time I stepped into the assembly hall, beneath streamers and balloons and the professionally suspicious gazes of bony female chaperones, all the best girls were already box-stepping and Mexican-hatting with absurdly smug partners. Naturally, the prefects had the pick of the ladies. I watched them with passionate envy. Guzda and Joshi, and Stevenson and Rushdie, and Taliarkhan and Teabali, and Jaswala, and Wagley and King. I tried butting in on them during excuse-me's, but when they saw my bandage and my cucumber of a nose and the stains on my face, they just laughed and turned their backs. Hatred burgeoning in my bosom, I ate potato chips and drank Bubble Up and Vimto and told myself, those jerks, if they knew who I was, they'd get out of my way pretty damn quick. But still, the fear of revealing my true nature was stronger than my somewhat abstract desire for the whirling European girls. "Hey, Salim, isn't it? Hey, man, what happened to you?" I was dragged out of my bitter, solitary reverie. Even Sonny had someone to dance with, but then he had his forceps hollows, and he didn't wear underpants. There were reasons for his attractiveness. By a voice behind my left shoulder, a low, throaty voice full of promises, but also of menace, a girl's voice. I turned with a sort of jump and found myself staring at a vision with golden hair and a prominent and famous chest. My God, she was 14 years old. Why was she talking to me? "My name is Masha Miovich," the vision said. "I've met your sister." Of course! The monkey's heroines, the swimmers from Walsingham School, would certainly know the school's champion breaststroker. "I know," I stuttered, "I know your name." "And I know yours," she straightened my tie. "So that's fair." Over her shoulder, I saw Glandy Keith and Fat Purse watching us in drooling paroxysms of envy. I straightened my back and pushed out my shoulders. Masha Miovich asked about my bandage. "It's nothing," I said in what I hoped was a deep voice. "A sporting accident." And then, working feverishly to hold my voice steady, "Would you like to dance?" "Okay," said Masha Miovich, "but don't try any smooching." Salim takes the floor with Masha Miovich, swearing not to smooch. Salim and Masha, doing the Mexican hat. Masha and Salim, box-stepping with the best of them. I allow my face to adopt a superior expression. You see, you don't have to be a prefect to get a girl. The dance ended, and still on top of my wave of elation, I said, "Would you care for a stroll, you know, in the quad?" Masha Miovich, smiling privately, "Well, yeah, just for a sec. But hands off, okay?" Hands off, Salim swears. Salim and Marsha taking the air. Man, this is fine. This is the life. Goodbye, Evie. Hello, breaststroke. Glandy, Keith Colliker and Fat Purse Fishwaller step out of the shadows of the quadrangle. They are giggling. Hee-hee! Masha Miovich looks puzzled as they block our path. Ho-ho! Fat Purse says. Masha, ho-ho! Some date you got there, and I shut up you. Whereupon Glandy Keith, you want to know how he got his war wound, Mashy? And Fat Purse, hee-hoo-ha! Masha says, don't be crude. He got it in a sporting accident. Fat Purse and Glandy Keith are almost falling over with mirth, then Fishwaller reveals all. Zagalo pulled his hair out in class. Hee-hee-ho! And Keith, snot-nose is a baldy. And both together, Sniff has got a map face. There is puzzlement on Marsha Miovich's face, and something more, some budding spirit of sexual mischief. Salim, they're being so rude about you. Yes, I say, ignore them. I try to edge her away, but she goes on, you aren't going to let them get away with it. There are beads of excitement on her upper lip. Her tongue is in the corner of her mouth. The eyes of Marsha Miovich say, what are you, a man or a mouse? And under the spell of the champion breaststroker, something else floats into my head. The image of two irresistible knees, and now I am rushing at Colliker and Fishwaller. While they are distracted by giggles, my knee drives into Glandy's groin. Before he's dropped, a similar genuflection has laid Fat Purse low. I turn to my mistress. She applauds softly. Hey, man, pretty good. But now my moment has passed, and Fat Purse is picking himself up, and Glandy Keith is already moving towards me, abandoning all pretense of manhood. I turn and run. And the two bullies are after me, and behind them comes Marsha Miovich calling, where are you running, little hero? But there's no time for her now. Mustn't let them get me into the nearest classroom and try and shut the door. But Fat Purse's foot is in the way, and now the two of them are inside too, and I dash at the door. I grab it with my right hand, trying to force it open. Get out if you can. They are pushing the door shut, but I'm pulling with the strength of my fear. I have it open a few inches, my hand curl around it, and now Fat Purse slams all his weight behind the door, and it shuts too fast for me to get my hand out of the way, and it's shut. A thud, and outside, Marsha Miovich arrives and looks down at the floor and sees the top third of my middle finger lying there like a lump of well-chewed bubble gum. This was the point at which she fainted. No pain. Everything very far away. Fat Purse and Glandy Keith fleeing, to get help or to hide. I look at my hand out of pure curiosity. My finger has become a fountain. Red liquid spurts out to the rhythm of my heartbeat. Never knew a finger held so much blood. Pretty. Now here's Nurse. Don't worry, Nurse. Only a scratch. Your parents are being phoned. Mr. Crusoe is getting his car keys. Nurse is putting a great wad of cotton wool over the stump, filling up like red candy floss. And now, Crusoe, get in the car, Salim. Your mother is going straight to the hospital. Yes, sir. And the bit? Has anybody got the bit? Yes, Headmaster, here it is. Thank you, Nurse. Probably no use, but you never know. Hold this while I drive, Salim. And holding up my severed fingertip in my unmutilated left hand, I am driven to the Breach Candy Hospital through the echoing streets of night. At the hospital, white walls, stretchers, everyone talking at once. Words pour around me like fountains. Oh, God preserve us, my little piece of the moon. What have they done to you? To which old Crusoe, hey, hey, Mrs. Sinai, accidents will happen, boys will be... But my mother enraged, what kind of school, Mr. Caruso? I'm here with my son's finger in pieces, and you tell me, not good enough, sir, no, sir. And now, while Crusoe, actually the name's like Robinson, you know, the doctor is approaching, and a question is being asked. Whose answer will change the world? Mrs. Sinai, your blood group, please. The boy has lost blood. A transfusion may be necessary. And Amina, I am A, but my husband O. And now she is crying, breaking down. And still the doctor, ah, in that case, are you aware of your son's but she, the doctor's daughter, must admit she cannot answer the question. Alpha or Omega?
Well, in that case, a very quick test. But on the subject of rhesus...
My mother, through her tears, both my husband and I, rhesus positive. And the doctor?
Well, good, that at least.
But when I am on the operating table...
Just sit there, son. I'll give you a local anaesthetic, no?
Madam, he's in shock. Total anaesthesia would be impossible. All right, son, just hold your finger up and still. Help him, nurse, and it'll be over in a jiffy. While the surgeon is sewing up the stump and performing the miracle of transplanting the roots of the nail, all of a sudden there's a fluster in the background, a million miles away, and... Have you got a second, Mrs. Sinai? And I can't hear properly. Words float across the infinite distance. Mrs. Sinai, you are sure. O and A and O, and rhesus negative, both of you. Heterozygous or homozygous? No, there must be some mistake. How can he be? I'm sorry, absolutely clear. Positive, and neither A nor... Excuse me, madam, but is he your... Not adopted, or... The hospital nurse interposes herself between me and miles away chatter, but it's no good, because now my mother is shrieking.
But of course you must believe me, doctor. My God, of course he is our son.
Neither A nor O. And the rhesus factor, impossibly negative. And zygosity offers no clues. And present in the blood, rare Kell antibodies. And my mother crying, 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 crying.
I don't understand. A doctor's daughter, and I don't understand.
Have Alpha and Omega unmasked me? Is rhesus pointing its unanswerable finger? And will Mary Pereira be obliged to... I wake up in a cool, white, Venetian-blinded room with all India Radio for company. Tony Brent is singing Red Sails in the Sunset. Amit Sinai, his face ravaged by whiskey and now by something worse, stands beside the Venetian blind. Amina, speaking in whispers, again snatches across the million miles of distance. Janum, please, I beg you. No, what are you saying? Of course it was. Of course you are the... How could you think I would... Who could it have? Oh, God, don't just stand and look. I swear on my mother's head. Now, shh, he is... A new song from Tony Brent, whose repertoire today is uncannily similar to Wee Willie Winkie's. How much is that doggy in the window? Hangs in the air, floating on radio waves. My father advances on my bed, towers over me. I've never seen him look like this before. Abba. And he, I should have known. Just look. Where am I in that face? That nose, I should have... He turns on his heel and leaves the room. My mother follows him, too distraught to whisper now. No, Janum, I won't let you believe such things about me. I'll kill myself. I'll... And the door swings shut behind them. There is a noise outside, like a clap or a slap. Most of what matters in your life takes place in your absence. Tony Brent begins crooning his latest hit into my good ear and assures me melodiously that the clouds will soon roll by. And now I, Salim Sinai, intend briefly to endow myself then with the benefits of hindsight, destroying the unities and conventions of fine writing. I make him cognizant of what was to come, purely so that he can be permitted to think the following thoughts. O eternal opposition of inside and outside, because a human being inside himself is anything but a whole, anything but homogeneous. All kinds of every which thing are jumbled up inside him, and he is one person one minute and another the next. The body, on the other hand, is homogeneous as anything, indivisible, a one-piece suit, a sacred temple, if you will. It is important to preserve this wholeness. But the loss of my finger, which was conceivably foretold by the pointing digit of Raleigh's fisherman, not to mention the removal of certain hairs from my head, has undone all that. Thus we enter into a state of affairs which is nothing short of revolutionary, and its effect on history is bound to be pretty damn startling. Uncork the body, and God knows what you permit to come tumbling out. Suddenly you are forever other than you were, and the world becomes such that parents can cease to be parents, and love can turn to hate. And these, mark you, are only the effects on private life. The consequences for the sphere of public action, as will be shown, are, were, will be no less profound. Finally, withdrawing my gift of foreknowledge, I leave you with the image of a 10-year-old boy with a bandaged finger, sitting in a hospital bed, musing about blood and noises like claps, and the expression on his father's face, zooming out slowly into long shot. I allow the soundtrack music to drown my words, because Tony Brent is reaching the end of his medley, and his finale, too, is the same as Winky's. Good night, ladies, is the name of the song. Merrily it rolls along, rolls along, rolls along. Fade out. The Kolynos Kid. From Ayah to Widow. I've been the sort of person to whom things have been done. But Salim Sanai, perennial victim, persists in seeing himself as protagonist. Despite Mary's crime, setting aside typhoid and snake venom, dismissing two accidents in washing chest and circus ring, when Sonny Ibrahim, master lockbreaker, permitted my budding horns of temples to invade his forcep hollows, and through this combination unlocked the door to the midnight children, disregarding the effects of Evie's push and my mother's infidelity, in spite of losing my hair to the bitter violence of Emil Zagalo and my finger to the lip-licking goads of Marsha Miovich, setting my face against all indications to the contrary, I shall now amplify in the manner and with the proper solemnity of a man of science my claim to a place at the centre of things.
Your life, which will be, in a sense, the mirror of our own, the Prime Minister wrote, obliging me scientifically to face the question, in what sense? How, in what terms, may the career of a single individual be said to impinge on the fate of a nation? I must answer in adverbs and hyphens. I was linked to history both literally and metaphorically, both actively and passively, in what are admirably modern scientists might term modes of connection, composed of dualistically combined configurations of the two pairs of opposed adverbs given above. This is why hyphens are necessary. Actively, literally, passively metaphorically, actively metaphorically, and passively literally. I was inextricably entwined with my world. Sensing Padma's unscientific bewilderment, I revert to the inexactitudes of common speech. By the combination of active and literal, I mean, of course, all actions of mine, which directly, literally, affected or altered the course of seminal historical events. For instance, the manner in which I provided the language marches with their battle cry. The union of passive and metaphorical encompasses all socio-political trends and events which, merely by existing, affected me metaphorically. For example, by reading between the lines of the episode entitled The Fisherman's Pointing Finger, you will perceive the unavoidable connection between the infant state's attempts at rushing towards full-sized adulthood and my own early explosive efforts at growth. Next, passive and literal, when hyphenated, cover all moments at which national events had a direct bearing upon the lives of myself and my family. Under this heading, you should file the freezing of my father's assets, and also the explosion at Volkeshvar Reservoir, which unleashed the Great Cat Invasion. And finally, there is the mode of the active metaphorical, which groups together those occasions on which things done by or to me were mirrored in the macrocosm of public affairs, and my private existence was shown to be symbolically at one with history. The mutilation of my middle finger was a case in point, because when I was detached from my fingertip and blood, neither alpha nor omega, rushed out in fountains, a similar thing happened to history. And all sorts of every which thing began pouring out all over us. But because history operates on a grander scale than any individual, it took a good deal longer to stitch it back together
and mop up the mess. Passive metaphorical, passive literal, active metaphorical. The Midnight Children's Conference was all three. But it never became what I most wanted it to be. We never operated in the first, most significant of the modes of connection. The active literal passed us by. Transformation without end. Nine-fingered Salim has been brought to the doorway of the Breach Candy Hospital by a squat blonde nurse whose face is frozen into a smile of terrifying insincerity. He is blinking in the hot glare of the outside world, trying to focus on two swimming shadow shapes coming towards him out of the sun. "See," the nurse coos, "see who's come to get you then." And Salim realizes that something terrible has gone wrong with the world, because his mother and father, who should have come to collect him, have apparently been transformed en route into his aunt Mary Pereira and his uncle Hanif. Hanif Aziz boomed like the horns of ships in the harbour and smelled like an old tobacco factory. I loved him dearly, for his laughter, his unshaven chin, his air of having been put together rather loosely, his lack of coordination which made his every movement fraught with risk. When he visited Buckingham Villa, my mother hid the cut-glass vases. Adults never trusted him to behave with proper decorum. "Watch out for the communists," he bellowed, and they blushed, which was a bond between himself and all children, other people's children, since he and Pia were childless. Uncle Hanif, who would one day, without warning, take a walk off the roof of his home. He wallops me in the back, toppling me forwards into Mary's arms. "Hey, little wrestler, you look fine." But Mary hastily, "But so thin, Jesus, they haven't been feeding you properly. You want cornflour pudding, banana mashed with milk? Did they give you chips?" While Salim is looking round at this new world, in which everything seems to be going too fast, his voice, when it comes, sounds high-pitched, as though somebody has speeded it up. "Amma, Abba," he asks, "the monkey." And Hanif booms,
"Yes, tickety-boo. The boy is really ship-shape. Come on, fill one. A ride in my Packard, okay?"
And, talking at the same time, is Mary Pereira. "Chocolate cake?" she is promising. "Laddus, pista ki laus, meat samosas, kulfi. So thin you got, Baba. The wind will blow you away." The Packard is driving away. It is failing to turn off Warden Road, up the two-story hillock. And Salim, "Hanif, Mamu, where are we?" No time to get it out. Hanif roars,
"Your peer auntie is waiting. My God, you see if we don't have a number one good time."
His voice drops conspiratorially.
"Lots," he says darkly, "of fun."
And Mary, "Are Baba, yes, such steak and green chutney." "Not the dark one," I say, captured at last. Relief appears on the cheeks of my captors. "No, no, no," Mary babbles. "Light green, Baba, just like you like." And
pale green, Hanif is bellowing. "My God, green like grasshoppers."
All too fast. We are at Kemp's Corner now, cars rushing around like bullets. But one thing is unchanged. On his billboard, the Colinos kid is grinning. The eternal pixie grin of the boy in the green chlorophyll cap. The lunatic grin of the timeless kid who endlessly squeezes an inexhaustible tube of toothpaste onto a bright green brush. Keep teeth clean and keep teeth bright. Keep teeth Colinos super white. And you may wish to think of me, too, as an involuntary Colinos kid, squeezing crises and transformations out of a bottomless tube, extruding time onto my metaphorical toothbrush, clean, white time, with green chlorophyll in the stripes. This, then, was the beginning of my first exile. There will be a second and a third. I bore it uncomplainingly. I had guessed, of course, that there was one question I must never ask. That I had been loaned out like a comic book from the Scandal Point second-hand library for some indefinite period, and that when my parents wanted me back, they would send for me. When, or even if, because I blame myself not a little for my banishment. Had I not inflicted upon myself one more deformity to add to bandy legs, cucumber nose, horn temples, stained cheeks? Was it not possible that my mutilated finger had been, as my announcement of my voices had nearly been, for my long-suffering parents the last straw? That I was no longer a good business risk, no longer worth the investment of their love and protection. I decided to reward my uncle and aunt for their kindness in taking in so wretched a creature as myself, to play the model nephew and await events. There were times when I wished that the monkey would come and see me, or even call me on the phone, but dwelling on such matters only punctured the balloon of my equanimity. So I did my best to put them out of my mind. Besides, living with Hanif and Pir Aziz turned out to be exactly what my uncle had promised. Lots of fun. They made all the fuss of me that children expect, and accept graciously from childless adults. Their flat, overlooking Marine Drive, wasn't large, but there was a balcony from which I could drop monkey nutshells onto the heads of passing pedestrians. There was no spare bedroom, but I was offered a deliriously soft white sofa with green stripes, an early proof of my transformation into the Kolynos kid. Aya Mary, who had apparently followed me into exile, slept on the floor by my side. By day she filled my stomach with the promised cakes and sweetmeats, paid for, I now believe, by my mother. I should have grown immensely fat, except that I had begun once again to grow in other directions. And at the end of the year of accelerated history, when I was only 11 and a half, I had actually attained my full adult height, as if someone had grasped me by the folds of my puppy fat and squeezed them harder than any toothpaste tube, so that inches shot out of me under the pressure. Save from obesity by the Kolynos effect, I basked in my uncle and aunt's delight at having a child around the house. When I spilt 7 up on the carpet or sneezed into my dinner, the worst my uncle would say was, "Hi, you're a black man," in his booming steamship's voice, spoiling the effect by grinning hugely. Meanwhile, my Auntie Pier was becoming the next in a long series of women who have bewitched and finally undone me good and proper. I should mention that while I stayed in the Marine Drive apartment, my testicles, forsaking the protection of pelvic bone, decided prematurely and without warning to drop into their little sacks. This event, too, played its part in what followed. My mummy, my auntie, the divine Pia Aziz, to live with her was to exist in the hot, sticky heart of a Bombay talkie. In those days, my uncle's career in the cinema had entered a dizzy decline, and, for such is the way of the world, Pia's star had gone into decline along with his. In her presence, however, thoughts of failure were impossible. Deprived of film roles, Pia had turned her life into a feature picture in which I was cast in an increasing number of bit parts. I was the faithful body servant, Pia in petticoats, soft hips rounding towards my desperately averted eyes, giggling while her eyes, bright with antimony, flashed imperiously. "Come on, boy, what are you shy for? Hold these pleats in my sari while I fold." I was her trusted confidant, too. While my uncle sat on chlorophyll-striped sofa, pounding out scripts which nobody would ever film, I listened to the nostalgic soliloquy of my aunt, trying to keep my eyes away from two impossible orbs, spherical as melons, golden as mangoes. I refer, you will have guessed, to the adorable breasts of Pia Mumini. While she, sitting on her bed, one arm flung across her brow, declaimed, "Boy, you know I am great actress. I have interpreted several major roles, but look what fate will do. Once, boy, goodness knows who would beg absolutely to come to this flat. Once the reporters of Filmfare and Screen Goddess would pay black money to get inside. Yes, and dancing, and I was well known at Venice Restaurant. All of those great jazz men came to sit at my feet. Yes, even that brass boy after Lovers of Kashmir, who was a bigger star.
not Poppy, not Vijayantimala, not one person.
And I nodding emphatically, no, naturally nobody, while her wondrous skin-wrapped melons heaved and... With a dramatic cry she went on,
but even then, in the time of our world-beating fame, every picture, a golden jubilee movie, this uncle of yours wants to live in a two-room flat like a clerk. So I make no fuss. I am not like some of your cheap-type actresses. I live simply and ask for no Cadillacs or air conditioners or dunlopillow beds from England, no swimming pool shaped like bikinis like that Rakshi Vishwanathams. Here, like a wife of the masses, I have stayed. Here now I am rotting, rotting absolutely. But I know this. My face is my fortune. After that, what riches do I need?
And I, anxiously agreeing, Mumani, none at all. She shrieked wildly. Even my slap-deafened ear was penetrated.
Yes, of course, you also want me to be poor. All the world wants Pierre to be in rags. Even that one, your uncle, writing his boring, boring scripts. Oh, my God. I tell him, put in dances or exotic locations. Make your villains villainous. Why not make heroes like men? But he says, no, all that is rubbish. He sees that now. Although once he was not so proud. Now he must write about ordinary people and social problems. And I say, yes, Hanif, do that. That is good. But put in a little comedy routine, a little dance for your peer to do, and tragedy and drama also. That is what the public is wanting. Her eyes were brimming with tears. So you know what he is writing now? About,
she looked as if her heart would break,
the ordinary life of a pickle factory.
Shh, Mumanish, I beg. Hanif Mamu will hear.
Let him hear, she stormed, weeping copiously now. Let his mother hear also in Agra. They will make me die for shame.
Reverend Mother had never liked her actress daughter-in-law. I overheard her once telling my mother,
to marry an actress, what's his name? My son has made his bed in the gutter. Soon, what's his name, she will be making him drink alcohol and also eat some pig.
Eventually, she accepted the inevitability of the match with bad grace. But she took to writing improving epistles to Pia.
Listen, daughter, she wrote, don't do this actressy thing. Why do such shameless behaviour? Work, yes, you girls have modern ideas, but to dance naked on the screen, when for a small sum only you could acquire the concession on a good petrol pump. From my own pocket I would get it for you in 2 minutes. Sit in an office, hire attendants, that is proper work.
None of us ever knew whence Reverend Mother acquired her dream of petrol pumps, which would be the growing obsession of her old age. But she bombarded Pia with it, to the actress's disgust.
Why, that woman doesn't ask me to be shorthand typist, Pia wailed to her niece and Mary at me at breakfast. Why not taxi driver or handloom weaver? I tell you, this pumpery shumpery makes me wild.
My uncle quivered, for once in his life, on the edge of anger.
There is a child present, he said, and she is your mother. Show her respect.
Respect she can have, Pierre flounced from the room, but she wants gas.
And my most treasured bit part of all was played out when during Pierre and Anise's regular card games with friends, I was promoted to occupy the sacred place of the son she never had. Child of an unknown union, I have had more mothers than most mothers have children. Giving birth to parents has been one of my stranger talents. A form of reverse fertility, beyond the control of contraception, and even of the widow herself. In the company of visitors, Pia Aziz would cry,
Look, friends, here's my own crown prince, the jewel in my ring, the pearl in my necklace.
and she would draw me towards her, cradling my head so that my nose was pushed down against her chest and nestled wonderfully between the soft pillows of her indescribable... Unable to cope with such delights, I pulled my head away. But I was her slave, and I know now why she permitted herself such familiarity with me. Prematurely testicled, growing rapidly, I nevertheless wore, fraudulently, the badge of sexual innocence. Salim Sanai, during his sojourn at his uncle's home, was still in shorts. Bare knees proved my childishness to peer. Deceived by ankle socks, she held my face against her breast, while her sitar perfect voice whispered in my good ear, "Child, child, don't fear. Your clouds will soon roll by." For my uncle, as well as my histrionic aunt, I acted out with growing polish the part of the surrogate son. Hanif Aziz was to be found during the day on the striped sofa, pencil and exercise book in hand, writing his pickle epic. He wore his usual lungi, wound loosely around his waist and fastened with an enormous safety pin. His legs protruded hairily from its folds. His fingernails bore the stains of a lifetime of gold flakes. His toenails seemed similarly discoloured. I imagine him smoking cigarettes with his toes. Highly impressed by the vision, I asked him if he could, in fact, perform this feat. And without a word, he inserted gold flake between big toe and its sidekick, and wound himself into bizarre contortions. I clapped wildly, but he seemed to be in some pain for the rest of the day. I ministered to his needs as a good son should, emptying ashtrays, sharpening pencils, bringing water to drink, while he, who, after his fabulous beginnings, had remembered that he was his father's son and dedicated himself against everything which smacked of the unreal, scribbled out his ill-fated screenplay.
"Sonny Jim," he informed me, "this damn country has been dreaming for 5,000 years. It's about time it started waking up."
Hanif was fond of railing against princes and demons, gods and heroes, against, in fact, the entire iconography of the Bombay film. In the Temple of Illusions, he had become the high priest of reality, while I, conscious of my miraculous nature, which involved me beyond all mitigation in the Hanif-despised myth-life of India, bit my lip and didn't know where to look. Hanif Aziz, the only realistic writer working in the Bombay film industry, was writing the story of a pickle factory, created, run, and worked in entirely by women. There were long scenes describing the formation of a trade union. There were detailed descriptions of the pickling process. He would quiz Mary Pereira about recipes. They would discuss for hours the perfect blend of lemon, lime and garam masala. It is ironic that this arch-disciple of naturalism should have been so skillful, if unconscious, a prophet of his own family's fortunes. In the indirect kisses of the lovers of Kashmir, he foretold my mother and her Nadir Kasim's meetings at the Pioneer Cafe, and in his unfilmed chutney scenario too, there lurked a prophecy of deadly accuracy. He besieged Homi Katrak with scripts. Katrak produced none of them. They sat in the small marine drive apartment, covering every available surface, so that you had to pick them off the toilet seat before you could lift it. But Katrak, out of charity, or for another soon-to-be-revealed reason, paid my uncle a studio salary. That was how they survived, Hanif and Pia, on the largesse of the man who would, in time, become the second human being to be murdered by mushrooming Salim. Homi Katrak begged him, "Maybe just one love scene." "And Pia, what do you think village people are going to give their rupees to see women pickling Alfonsos?" But Hanif, obdurately,
"This is a film about work, not kissing. And nobody pickles Alfonsos. You must use mangoes with bigger stones."
The ghost of Joe da Costa did not, so far as I know, follow Mary Pereira into exile. However, his absence only served to increase her anxiety. She began, in these marine drive days, to fear that he would become visible to others besides herself. and reveal, during her absence, the awful secrets of what happened at Dr. Nalika's nursing home on Independence Night. So each morning she left the apartment in a state of jelly-like worry, arriving at Buckingham Villa in near collapse. Only when she found that Joe had remained both invisible and silent did she relax. But after she returned to Marine Drive laden with samosas and cakes and chutneys, her anxiety began to mount once again. But as I had resolved, having troubles enough of my own, to keep out of all heads except the children's, I did not understand why. Panic attracts panic. On her journey, sitting in jam-packed buses, the trams had just been discontinued, Mary heard all sorts of rumours and tittle-tattle, which she relayed to me as matters of absolute fact. According to Mary, the country was in the grip of a sort of supernatural invasion. "Yes, Baba," they say in Kurukshetra, "an old Sikh woman woke up in a hut and saw the old-time war of the Kurus and Pandavas happening right outside. It was in the papers and all. She pointed to the place where she saw the chariots of Arjun and Kama, and there were truly wheel marks in the mud. Bap re bap, such so bad things. At Gwalior, they have seen the ghost of the Rani of Jhansi. Rakshasas have been seen many-headed like Ravana, doing things to women and pulling down trees with one finger. I am good Christian woman, Baba, but it gives me fright when they tell that the tomb of Lord Jesus is found in Kashmir. On the tombstones are carved two pierced feet, and a local fisherwoman has sworn she saw them bleeding, real blood. God save us on Good Friday! What is happening, Baba? Why these old things can't stay dead and not plague honest folk? And I, wide-eyed, listening, and although my Uncle Hanif roared with laughter, I remain today half convinced that in that time of accelerated events and diseased hours, the past of India rose up to confound her present. The newborn, secular state was being given an awesome reminder of its fabulous antiquity, in which democracy and votes for women were irrelevant, so that people were seized by atavistic longings and, forgetting the new myth of freedom, reverted to their old ways, their old regionalist loyalties and prejudices, and the body politic began to crack. As I said, lop off just one fingertip and you never know what fountains of confusion you will unleash. And cows, Baba, have been vanishing into thin air, poof! And in the villages the peasants must starve. It was at this time that I, too, was possessed by a strange demon. But in order that you may understand me properly, I must begin my account of the episode on an innocent evening, when Hanif and Pir Aziz had a group of friends round for cards. My auntie was prone to exaggerate, because although Filmfare and Screen Goddess were absent, my uncle's house was a popular place. On card evenings, it would burst at the seams with jazzmen gossiping about quarrels and reviews in American magazines, and singers who carried throat sprays in their handbags, and members of the Uday Shankar dance troupe, which was trying to form a new style of dance by fusing Western ballet with Bharatanatyam. There were musicians who had been signed up to perform in the All India Radio Music Festival, the Sangeet Sammelan. There were painters who argued violently amongst each other. The air was thick with political and other chatter. As a matter of fact, I am the only artist in India who paints with a genuine sense of ideological commitment. Oh, it's too bad about Ferdi. He'll never get another band after this. Menon, don't talk to me about Krishna. I knew him when he had principles. I myself have never abandoned. Oh, hey, Hanif, yeah? Why we don't see Lal Kasimir these days? And my uncle, looking anxiously towards me, "Shh, what Kasim? I don't know any person by that name." And mingling with the hubbub in the apartment, there was the evening colour and noise of Marine Drive. Promenaders with dogs, buying chambeli and chana from hawkers, the cries of beggars and belpuri vendors, and the lights coming on in a great arcing necklace round and up to Malabar Hill. I stood on the balcony with Mary Pereira, turning my bad ear to her whispered rumours, the city at my back and the crowding, chatting card schools before my eyes. And one day, amongst the card players, I recognised the sunken-eyed ascetic form of Mr. Homi Katrak, who greeted me with embarrassed heartiness.
"Hi there, young chap. Doing fine? Of course you are."
My uncle Hanif played rummy dedicatedly, but he was in the thrall of a curious obsession, namely that he was determined never to lay down a hand until he completed a 13-card sequence in hearts. Always hearts, all the hearts, and nothing but the hearts would do. In his quest for this unattainable perfection, my uncle would discard perfectly good threes of a kind, and whole sequences of spades, clubs, diamonds, to the raucous amusement of his friends. I heard the renowned Shanghai player Ustad Changiz Khan, who dyed his hair so that on hot evenings the tops of his ears were discoloured by running black fluid, tell my uncle, "Come on, mister, leave this hard business and just play like the rest of us fellows." My uncle confronted temptation, then boomed above the din,
"No, damn it, go to the devil and leave me to my game."
He played cards like a fool, but I, who had never seen such singleness of purpose, felt like clapping. One of the regulars at Hanif Aziz's legendary card evenings was a Times of India staff photographer, who was full of sharp tales and scurrilous stories. My uncle introduced me to him.
"Here's the fellow who put you on the front page, Salim. Here is Kalidas Gupta, a terrible photographer, a really badmash type. Don't talk to him too long. He'll make your head spin with scandal."
Kalidas had a head of silver hair and a nose like an eagle. I thought he was wonderful. "Do you really know scandals?" I asked him. But all he said was, "Son, if I told, they would make your ears burn." But he never found out that the evil genius, the Eminence Grise, behind the greatest scandal the city had ever known was none other than Salim Snotnose. I mustn't race ahead. The affair of the curious baton of Commander Sabarmati must be recounted in its proper place. Effects must not, despite the tergiversatory nature of time in 1958, be permitted to precede causes. I was alone on the balcony. Mary Pereira was in the kitchen helping Pierre to prepare sandwiches and cheese pakoras. Hanif Aziz was immersed in his search for the 13 hearts. And now Mr. Homi Katrak came out to stand beside me.
"Breath of fresh air," he said.
"Yes, sir," I replied. "So," he exhaled deeply, "so, so, life is treating you good? Excellent little fellow. Let me shake you by the hand." 10-year-old hand is swallowed up by film magnate's fist. The left hand, the mutilated right hand, hangs innocently by my side. And now, a shock. Left palm feels paper being thrust into it, sinister paper inserted by dexterous fist. Katrak's grip tightens, his voice becomes low but also cobra-like, sibilant, inaudible in the room with the green-striped sofa. His words penetrate my one good ear.
"Give this to your auntie, secretly, secretly. Can do, and keep mum, or I'll send the police to cut your tongue out."
And now loud and cheery, "Good! Glad to see you in such high spirits." Homi Katrak is patting me on the head and moving back to his game. Threatened by policemen, I have remained silent for 2 decades, but no longer. Now everything has to come out. The card school broke up early.
"The boy has to sleep," Pierre was whispering. "Tomorrow he goes to school again."
I found no opportunity of being alone with my aunt. I was tucked up on my sofa with the note still clutched in my left fist. Mary was asleep on the floor. I decided to feign a nightmare. Deviousness did not come unnaturally to me. Unfortunately, however, I was so tired that I fell asleep, and in the event there was no need to pretend, because I dreamed the murder of my classmate Jimmy Kapadia. We are playing football in the main stairwell at school, on red tiles, slipping, sliding. A black cross is set in blood-red tiles. Mr. Crusoe at the head of the stairs. Mustn't slide down the banisters, boys. That cross is where one boy fell. Jimmy plays football on the cross. The cross is lies, Jimmy says. They tell you lies to spoil your fun. His mother calls up on the telephone. Don't play, Jimmy, you're bad heart. The bell. The telephone replaced, and now the bell. Ink pellets stain the classroom air. Fat person, Glandy Keith, have fun. Jimmy wants a pencil, prods me in the ribs. Hey, man, you got a pencil? Give. Do dicks, man. I give. Zagallo enters. Zagallo's hand is up for silence. Look at my hair growing on his palm. Zagallo in pointy tin soldier hat. I must have my pencil back. Stretching out my finger, giving Jimmy a poke. Sir, please, look, sir, Jimmy fell. Sir, I saw, sir, Snotnose poked.
Snotnose shot Kapadia, sir.
Don't play, Jimmy. You're bad heart.
You be quiet, Zagallo cries. Jungle field, shut up.
Jimmy in a bundle on the floor.
Sir, sir, please, sir, will they put up a cross?
He borrowed a pencil. I poked. He fell. His father is a taxi driver. Now the taxi drives into class. A dhobi bundle is put on the back seat. Out goes Jimmy. Ding! A bell. Jimmy's father puts down the taxi flag. Jimmy's father looks at me.
Snotnose, you'll have to pay the fare.
But please, sir, haven't got the money, sir.
And Zagallo, we'll put it on your bill.
See my hair on Zagallo's hand. Flames are pouring from Zagallo's eyes. 500 million, what's one death? Jimmy is dead. 500 million still alive. I start counting. 1, 2, 3. Numbers march over Jimmy's grave. 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 4. Who cares if anyone dies? 100 million and 1, 2, 3. Numbers march through the classroom now, crushing, pounding, 200 million, 3, 4, 5, 500 million still alive, and only one of me. In the dark of the night, I awoke from the dream of Jimmy Kapadia's death, which became the dream of annihilation by numbers, yelling, howling, screaming, but still with the paper in my fist, and a door flew open to reveal my Uncle Hanif and Aunt Pia. Mary Pereira tried to comfort me, but Pierre was imperious. She was a divine swirl of petticoats and dupatta. She cradled me in her arms.
Never mind, my diamond, never mind now.
And Uncle Hanif sleepily.
Hey, Phil One, it's okay now. Come on, you. Come with us. Bring the boy, Pierre.
And now I'm safely in Pierre's arms.
Just for tonight, my pearl, you can sleep with us.
And there I am, nestling between aunt and uncle, huddling against my mummy's perfumed curves. Imagine, if you can, my sudden joy. Imagine with what speed the nightmare fled from my thoughts as I nestled against my extraordinary aunt's petticoats, as she rearranged herself to get comfortable and one golden melon caressed my cheek. As Pierre's hand sought out mine and grasped it firmly. Now I discharge my duty. When my aunt's hand wrapped itself around mine, paper passed from palm to palm. I felt her stiffen silently. Then, although I snuggled up closer, 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 she was lost to me. She was reading in the dark, and the stiffness of her body was increasing, and then suddenly, I knew that I had been tricked, that Cataract was my enemy, and only the threat of policemen prevented me from telling my uncle. At school the next day, I was told of Jimmy Kapadia's tragic death, suddenly at home, of a heart seizure. Is it possible to kill a human being by dreaming his death? My mother always said so, and in that case, Jimmy Kapadia was my first murder victim. Homi Cataract was to be the next. When I returned from my first day back at school, having